Hey, it's Wendy. I'm back with a new podcast episode today. And in fact, I'm here with a whole entire podcast series. And this series is going to be one where I interview all of the new instructors that are going to be instructors in Fodder School 3. And I'm really excited to bring this to you because everyone has a story and I can't wait to tell all of their stories. So without further ado, I bring you today's podcast episode. Welcome to Show Up or Shut Up, a podcast about prolific makers, specifically in the world of mixed media art. I'm your host, Wendy Solganic, also known as Willa Wanders, and I'm here to explore the ups and sometimes the downs of being a prolific mixed media artist. I've been a maker my entire life, and I've had four, yes, four separate careers involving art. In each episode, we'll talk to artists about how they became prolific makers, why they make art, and the struggles they go through. We'll talk about being an online creative, social media, and how to navigate that world if that's what you're into. Whether you're a casual art lover of mixed media art and collage, or a serious artist making a living with art, whether you're a handmade book artist, an art journaler, a 3D assemblage creator, a fiber artist, a collage artist, or everything all at once, I hope you'll join me on this journey into the world of mixed media making. If you like this podcast, hit the subscribe button and leave a review. You can find me, Wendy, at willowanders.com and on Instagram at willa.wanders and at fodder.school. Welcome to Show Up or Shut Up. This is a very real podcast, so it's not made with fancy equipment. People are not in sound studios. People are at home recording with mostly low-tech equipment. So we don't have the world's greatest sound, but we have a lot of heart and love, and people like it anyway. People don't mind. People don't seem to have super high expectations or needs. So the first thing that I like to start every podcast, as long as I remember to do this, is before we get rolling, tell us where people can find you and your art so that they can look at it before they listen to the whole episode so that they can get a feeling about the type of art you make, and that will help them to understand who you are as they listen to your story. Could be Instagram, maybe you have a website, it could be a Facebook page, any place where you feel like, okay, this is a good reflection of my art.
Yeah, Instagram's probably the best place. And with my shortened name, Di, so short for Diane, so just Di dot Venter, my surname, which is V-E-N-T-E-R. It's kind of like the Smith of South Africa. So it's very common in South Africa, but not very common in the world. So
That's so interesting. I didn't know that Venter was such a popular name in South Africa. Okay, wow. Very interesting.
Yeah, for white Afrikaans-speaking South Africans. So my husband is of Afrikaans Dutch descent. So yeah, I took his surname.
Gotcha. So Venter is really a Dutch name.
Yeah. It's like one of those things where it starts out as a Dutch name. It was probably Van Venter or something like that. Yeah. And it ended up being sort of South Africanized.
What was your maiden name?
Prima. So it's my mother's parents are both of Scottish descent. So
can you spell that?
It's like coffee creamer without the A. C-R-E-M-E-R. Oh, sorry. I'm telling you that. So that was my mother's surname was Balfour, which is the Scottish. And my dad was Zimbabwean. So a Rhodesian. So
your
also
dad
very
was
mixed.
From Zimbabwe?
Yes.
He was born in Zimbabwe?
Yep.
That's so exotic.
So, well, as Africans, that's not very exotic. But
oh, that's interesting. How did his family always in Zimbabwe or did they come from somewhere else?
I think both. His parents were born there. But it'll have been colonization at some point. I think if you go back far enough, that side of the family's Dutch and maybe Belgian. I think I can't quite recall. But yeah, he was born and raised in Zimbabwe. He came to South Africa to do his dad and then my parents met there.
Wow, I could have a whole conversation with you on the side, not on the podcast, about that. I am not familiar with that phenomenon of, I mean, I'm definitely familiar of the phenomenon of Europeans moving to South Africa, because pretty much everywhere I go, I meet South Africans who live
And lots of us all over
in the United States. Yeah, there's plenty of South Africans living where I live, which is Cleveland, Ohio. And I've actually got blood relatives that live in South Africa or grew up in South Africa, but they're not close cousins or anything. But when I did my DNA, I could see where all my DNA matches were all over the world. And there were plenty of people in South Africa.
Well, I tell you what, if you get the opportunity to visit your family there, it is such an amazing place to go on a holiday. That is really, I mean, it's just got everything. It's like great food. The people, like very welcoming people. Like I always tell my friends, with little people with kids, like it's a place to go because people like, they just love kids. And so you're it's a bit like Italy in that way. Like you go to Germany and your children are like a nuisance to everybody around you. But you go to Italy and South Africa and they're like welcomed with open arms, carried off while you enjoy your dinner kind of thing.
Wow.
And the food is amazing. The wine is amazing. The countryside is just absolutely beautiful. And there's just so much to see. There's obviously it's the big city, but then we've also got what we call the bush, what you guys call safari. Game farms. And I mean, those are just amazing. Like it's, yeah. So if you get the chance, do go.
It sounds amazing. So how old were you when you left?
So it was after I got married. Eugene is South African born and bred, but like his mom came from Holland when she was a teenager. And I think she just instilled in them this absolute love of travel. And so I should have known when I met him, he had just lived in 4 countries in 3 years, something like that. And he had just come back to South Africa after those, I think, 3 countries in 4 years. I think that was it. And then we met. And when we eventually started dating, it was like, we met through mutual friends. And when we eventually started dating, it was like, okay, engaged and married within a year. And then I think a year later, the first move we made was to Germany. So I think we've been married 16 years now. So we've been traveling for nearly all of that.
Wow. And how is it that is it like something where someone's job is taking them to all these places, or are you guys moving with or without a job?
No, it's always with a job. It's Eugene's work, but I always joke with like when people say, oh, is your husband in the Navy or military or something? I'm like, no, he's just nomadic. His moves have always been within his company, like intercompany transfer kind of ideas, but he's always gravitated towards those opportunities. So yeah, Germany for nearly 7 years, then the south of the UK for 2 years, then the middle of the UK for 2 years. And now we've been in the States for coming up 6 years.
And everywhere you go, if it's a language spoken that's not English, do you immerse yourself in that culture? Do you take classes? How do you, did you learn German when you lived in
Germany? I learned bad German. So I always say I can get by, like I can understand people, they can understand me, but my grammar is terrible. My pronunciation's probably not ideal, but you know, I don't know, like people do, but I find like I need to understand the world around me. I feel like you don't integrate yourself if you don't speak the language.
Right.
Yeah, learning German as an adult was fun because it is not an easy language to learn. I think so. South Africa, I grew up obviously during apartheid. And so the main two languages were English and Afrikaans. There's an interesting history behind the language, but it's basically the settlers were needing to communicate with the local people. And so they made this very sort of simplified Dutch with a mix of, because there were French Huguenots, there were the Portuguese in Mozambique. And so there were a few words from all the languages and they called it kitchen Dutch because it was like simplified to be able to communicate. And so that's the origins of Afrikaans. But the sort of pronunciations and the sentence structure is a lot like German. So that did help somewhat.
Gotcha. Okay. Is it considered a Germanic language? I've heard that term before, Germanic language.
I think so. I think it's, yeah, it's not Latin. I think, Wendy, now we're getting into it.
We don't have to. Very fascinated by human history and
I know,
and human migration around the world and how we get to. Sometimes I think I can't believe I live where I live and this is my home. And like, how did I even get here? Sometimes I think my genes are not from here, but I'm here.
Like, it's back to me. Mind-boggling. Like, everybody else did their DNA to find lost relatives or whatever. I was just curious, you know, what am I a mix of? Because South Africans, we're a mix of everything. We call ourselves the Rainbow Nation. We truly are. Like, nobody is. I think the original people were the Khoisan and the Khoikhoi, I think it is. And that's like Bushmen, the start of civilization. And there are a few of those people left. But otherwise, we are a total mix. So yeah, that to me was interesting.
Wow. Super fascinating. So where does art fit into all of this? Is art something that you've always been doing, or is it something that came later in life?
So that's my mom. So now you have to bear with my accent, because I said this to a friend of mine once, that my mom is artistic, and she heard me say that my mom is autistic. So my mom is artistic, very arty. And so we grew up doing, like, it was always considered, like, in my generation in South Africa, you had to do sort of sciences and for schooling. But so art was always, in those days, just considered hobby and fun. I was very much discouraged to even take art in high school. It was fine when it was just like something for fun, but it wasn't encouraged to be something for serious. So my mom's always done it as a hobby. And growing up, we were always had all the art supplies and very much encouraged to have fun with it. But it wasn't something you were encouraged to do. Now I think, I'd love to have gone to art school and got into like architecture or something like that. But in those days, in that generation, it was fun. So anyway, I left school. I started a medical degree, and then I decided I didn't want to do that. I have a degree in accounting and economics, I guess. But then when we moved, it's not what I've ever worked in. I've had worked in decorating, and I have to be careful even when you say that, because in the UK, when I told people I worked in decorating, they thought I painted walls, because that's what they call a decorator, somebody that comes and paints your house walls inside. So no.
Okay, I'm not going to let you skip over how you went from studying accounting and economics to I'm working in decorating, which that's kind of a big deal to me, at least, or I don't know, but people who work as interior designers, as decorators, with or without degrees, they have to have a lot of specialized knowledge. So how did you go from I'm having arts and crafts time with my mom to studying serious things to, okay, now I'm into decor?
So that's it. It's funny how life works out. Like, I was always meant to do something creative. And we were streamed in school, like IQ and grades. And then if you were in a certain class, like, you just had to do maths and science, and you could get it going to medicine or law, or that was the sort of trajectory. And I really should have been doing arts all the way through. That was always my passion and my interest. And I have a bit of a, like, I'm not very good at focusing on things that don't interest me. But as soon as I'm slightly interested, I'm like a dog with a bone, like
that's me.
I think it's all of us creative people. Don't try and make us do something but as soon as we're interested, I can tell you the like chemical formula of the watercolor because it interests me.
Yes.
Not quite, but crazy stuff.
Yes. So,
I was doing my commerce degree, and I was doing night classes so that I would have my days free so that I could work, because this was my first degree. My parents were like, okay, yes, they paid for that one. And then when I like messed around a bit, I was like, okay, you're on your own now. So it was a student loan, and it was paying for textbooks yourself and all of that fun stuff, which was probably a good thing because you do take it much more seriously when it's coming out of your own pocket. But I moved my study so that I could do night classes. And during the day, I wanted to work. And so I'd been like pottering about doing like Girl Friday jobs and awful things where you really realize, okay, like I have to get a degree of some sort because I really don't want to be the glorified tea lady the rest of my life. And so then a friend of mine told me that there was this position going at this in-house decor firm where it's soft furnishings, basically. So it's not like full interior design. It's all the curtains, blinds, cushions, bed valances, all of that type of thing. In those days, it was just moving out of all those like heavy drapery things to much more light, and the country style was coming in. And okay. So I applied for that job, like absolutely no background, but I knew how to sew and I knew how to do all pattern matching and like basic stuff like that. And I kind of just talked my way. And we got a lot of in-house training, which was amazing. Like we were just doing the fabric, coordinating the fabric suppliers and calculating at the fabric requirements and giving them the full out quote. And then we'd send the fabric all to the, what they call a CMT, it's a cut make trim, something I think it stands for, but it's the workshop that actually makes all the stuff. But the company would send us along to there to go see it for the day and see how everything was made. And so you learn so much. And then I would be on hand, like I have to be at the customer's house on the day for the installation. And me being me, I like don't stand around, just watch. I want to learn how to use a drill. I've never learned how to use a drill. And so I'd ask me, it was lovely at school. And I'd say to him, do you mind teaching me how to do that? And he was like, okay. And South Africa's not here with like insurance and liability on that. It's very much like much free and easy. So he was like, sure, climb up the ladder, I'll teach you how to use a drill. So he did. And all those like learning how to do all the like hand stuff like that. Girls, like in, I don't know, but when I was at school, I would have loved to have done woodwork and carpentry and things that the boys did. But the option for girls was home economics, which meant cooking and baking and recipe planning and really. And not fun in those days. It was, oh, I don't know. Oh, they didn't have some sewing in there. But again, you were making garments. I don't think anybody wore.
Right.
So anyway, I learned how to do all of that there. And it was an interesting and learning the right way to make. I can make Roman blinds now. I've done it. And I taught it when we lived in the UK. But then from there, I again talked my way into an advertising and marketing job within the fabric industry for one of the big fabric houses in South Africa. I was working with them because I was doing the soft furnishings. And so I knew they were hiring and I really wanted to get into that. And yeah, I talked my way to that job too, which was great fun. And that's what I did until I left South Africa. And then obviously when we left.
Well, everything you create that I've seen, now it's all starting to make a lot more sense. There's a history there.
You can see the...
Yeah, there's a history of what you specialize in now that is rooted in this time where you worked in the soft furnishings industry.
But it's funny because it's a bit like chicken and egg because I loved fabric since I was a little kid. I remember being told off by the lady at the fabric store and I was so upset because I'd gone with my mom to look at fabrics and I was touching them all. But I had clean hands and she told me, well, children mustn't touch the fabrics because, you know, kids have dirty hands. I was so upset. I said to my mom, she told me I had dirty hands. You always let me touch the fabrics. But yeah, I've loved fabrics. I love going fabric shopping with my mom since I was a tiny thing. So it's kind of always just been there.
Wow. Okay, so you leave South Africa. You leave this great job, it sounds
like. Oh, because I love that job.
Because your husband...
I was the most amazing woman.
Oh, gotcha. Because you leave because your husband has wanderlust.
Yeah.
And he wants to wander and live in different places. And so the next...
I had never lived outside of South Africa, so I was really keen to. It wasn't like it was a joint decision. I was totally happy to. I love my job, and I have amazing friends there, and I still miss them, of course. But yeah, it was such a good opportunity. You just couldn't really not do it.
Is that when you moved to Germany?
Yes. That was, and we were in Berlin. So
oh,
Berlin is just, the most amazing place to live. It was such fun.
What makes Berlin so amazing? I know that people do love that city.
It's interesting because Berliners always ask me, like, oh, but you're from Africa, isn't it? Don't you find it like so citified? And I was like, well, actually, I'm from Johannesburg, which is a big city. But that, oh, so Berlin is like, so you can go to a museum a day and not finish in a year. That's Berlin.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, some of the museums might not be your taste. Like, they're really some odd ones. It's Berlin. It's, yeah. Some of the things are a bit crazy.
It attracts artists. Is that basically what you're saying? Like, it attracts musicians and actors and artists and all sorts of artsy types?
Yeah. So Berliners call themselves anarchists. They won't even apologize for it. They're just like, well, I wanted to come and see you and I didn't have time to get out of my pajamas. But here I am. And it's not even, oh, gosh, like, I'm a bit embarrassed. I'm in my pajamas. No. So I don't know. There's just that like, focus on real stuff. Nobody cares what your hair looks in general. Nobody cares that you didn't brush your hair. And there's something, I mean, growing up in South Africa, we are much more conservative.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah, that's so interesting. Okay. So I feel like at least the United States is becoming much less formal over time, more like Berlin, where you could definitely show up in your pajamas and nobody would bat an eye. Okay. So you're in Berlin, this amazing city. And what do you look for a job? What do you do at this
point? So that was always going to be the hardest part because not speaking the language very well at all. And so I joined an amazing group called the Berlin International Women's Club, and it's women from all over the world. And it's like a mix of the German and English are the main languages, but there are a lot of English speakers. And through that, the International Women's Club offers classes and courses. And so you really, it's a great way to integrate yourself into the city you're in. They have them all over the world, International Women's Club. And there's also the American Women's SALCA, I think it's called Federation of American Women. Oh, now I've forgotten. But yeah, they've got these amazing resources for people who end up living away from their home country. And through that club, I started teaching sewing and textile art. And that opened a lot of opportunities. I was teaching the classes and then I would take commissions like for kiddies' clothing, little dresses, because it's an international group. A lot of people would want things that like they'd grown up dressing, like they had been dressed in, and they wanted to dress their children in those sort of things. Like I had a girl that I was friendly with from Savannah, and she loved those little, I don't know, like we would call them waterproofs, but they're not really. They're like nappy cover, diaper covers, those little frilly fabric, cute yes. little things. Yeah.
The cloth and diapers.
What do you call it?
Well, I guess it could be for cloth diapers or bloomers. I don't know.
Yeah, bloomers. Yeah, like little bloomer type things. Yeah. And then they've got a little top that fits over them. Traditionally, they were smocked, but smocking is at that stage wasn't something in my wheelhouse. I have since learned to do it. But I want one. Like that kind of, I find that sort of handwork a bit tedious. But anyway, those, they have a little top that goes, that's open at the back because it's so hot there. And the little ones run around just in those little, the cover fabric things and the little open toppies. So I would make things like that and pillow cushions with babies' names on as new baby presents, things like that. Baby changing mats. It seemed to be a lot around kids. A lot of people would order things for their own kids, for their friends' kids. So I ended up doing a lot of commission work like that.
There's a high demand for baby items and for the people who create for that market. It's a great way to apply your love of all these patterns and fabrics. And you can also apply your skills as a fine maker because people want good quality items. They want well-made items. So if you're good with cutting and sewing and picking things, oh my gosh, what a dream. That could definitely be something that could hold my attention for a while is just making diaper mats and top cloths.
Yeah.
All these beautiful items with beautiful little touches on.
And the nice thing with kiddies things is you're a lot more free. So things that would be a bit like not great on adults wear is lovely on babies wear. You have a lot, you know, when you walk around, I don't know, you've just got a lot
more freedom. Yeah, there's a lot more freedom. Yeah. I love that. So how long doing that, and how were you, was it all just word of mouth, or were you actively
all word of mouth? So not all word of mouth. So it was mostly like through the, so everybody knew I sewed because I was teaching the sewing classes. And then often the ladies would sign up for the sewing class, and then they would be like, oh, I love the sample you made. Can I have one like that? So at the time, I started doing machine embroidery. Eugene had bought me this amazing, I call it my monster machine, this big brother. There's beautiful, the machine that does all the embroidery for you.
Okay. Yeah. Like a computer embroidery.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I'd started doing that. But typical me, I love the look of the finished product, but I didn't want to buy other people's patterns and just use those. I wanted to create my own. And then I realized, oh, I have to learn to digitize. So you have to turn those, your own art, into patterns that the machine can read. And it's a lot more complex than I thought it would be. I thought, oh, you'll just upload your picture, it'll convert it. When you don't know, you just assume it's going to be simpler than it actually was. So I wanted to learn how to digitize. And I bought this incredibly specialist software to do that. And then realized just how hard it was to learn to use it. So they had this competition where you could win classes. It was like one-on-one, or I think there were like 10 of us that they accepted into the program. And you would get, it was like at the beginning of online, it was right at that sort of point. So you would all meet at a specific time and you would learn a skill together. And then you would have videos to watch and you'd have to practice everything. And then it's an American-based company, Artistic Threadworks. And there was a competition. You could send in a piece, and if they thought you had enough potential, basically the woman who owns the company, Holly, she was trying to find people who could digitize for her. So instead of bringing in people who knew other programs, I think like she thought, oh, I'll train people to use it and then hire them as digitizers. And so I learned how to do all of that. What that meant was that like people would have drawings that their children had done or things like that. And I could convert that into a bespoke stitch pattern and then put it onto their aprons. The kids wear these art aprons at creche and put it onto bags. They also have these like book bags that hang on their chairs. And so I could do all of that sort of bespoke embroidery, so converting, and people love having their kids' art done onto fabric and then framed or put onto
so cushions. You're saying you were living in Berlin and an American company who had created a technology to turn imagery into a digital thing that could be embroidered through a machine.
Yep.
Had hired you in Germany, essentially, through a competition that they held. And then one of the people who had that ability to take people's custom art and digitize it for the embroidery machine. But only a handful of people from all over the world were being trained in this very specialized skill.
With that specific thing, yes. So originally the competition was just to get the classes. And then afterwards, she hired a few of us to digitize her, which I did for a few years.
So a lot more people were taking the classes, because in every city, there's people who do custom embroidery.
Threadworks has like a website. So what they do is they don't do the actual embroidery. They sell the designs that you can download and use on your machine. They ran a competition and you could win a spot in their training program. And at the end of the training program, I think there were 10 or 15 of us that were in the training program. And at the end of the training program, I think they hired 4 of us to digitize designs for them. And then they sell those designs. Normally they give you the artwork and you just have to digitize it. So I was doing that as a side thing, but I've used the skills that I learned from that training program to make custom items in Berlin.
Gotcha. And at the time, you were living in Berlin. So the work that you're doing, you're then emailing them the file. So this is the beginning of work from home, remote work.
Exactly. So the thing that I started the right way, and then I got off track because I started doing all the like stuff that I could, if we moved again, I could take with me. And Germany, I had, although I did teach in-person classes and the word of mouth thing grew, my little sewing business grew hugely through that. So I had a nice balance of sewing items and teaching classes and only a teeny amount of online work. And then when we moved to the UK, I was still doing that online work. But then I got into more teaching. The textile art is big there. So I got into teaching more in-person classes, teaching textile arts, free motion embroidery, painting on fabric, like wearable art, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I noticed that in the UK, working with fabric is really big. There's a lot of textile artists. There's a lot of mixed media textile artists.
Yes.
Like a lot of people working in fabric and sewing and hand sewing and slow stitching, just way, way more people than percentage-wise than in the
US. Classes. You can take classes every day in the UK and learn something different. They're so many and they're so accessible and people love them. Like it's a much bigger thing. Well, I'm in California, so I don't know. I can't speak for the whole country, but certainly in California, the sewing classes are few and far between. Give you an example. When I was living in the UK, I drove out with a friend of mine. We drove out to the middle of the countryside. A girl whose husband, I think, is a dairy farmer. She's an artist. And so she opened the studio on the farm. So you drive out into the middle of nowhere and it's beautiful. It's all green and lush and just so pretty. And there's cows on the hill and sheep. You can just picture the English countryside. It's gorgeous. And the little river flowing down. And you drive down her little gravel drive to a barn and the whole side of the barn opens up and she's got all the textile art classes in there. And that day that I went, we made a fabric. Do you know those taxidermy things that people like on their wall, like animal heads? It's so not my thing. But we made them out of fabric, like a hair, a rabbit's head.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So I have a friend she loves everything I do except that. So it's like a love or hate thing. People come to my house and they're like, what on earth is that thing? Or they're like, where did you get that thing? So it's like, there's no in between. You either love it or you absolutely hate it. But yeah, so we did this class there for the day, had our lunch out on a big picnic trestle table with the cows roaming about us. And they went back in to carry on working for the afternoon. I mean, it's just magical.
But do you remember the name of this farm or the town that it's in? Some kind. People are probably going to want to know.
So she's since closed down, but there's another one like that called Hope and Elvis. And she does something similar. Oop. And it's also Hope and Elvis. Elvis. Yes. Elvis Presley. And she does something. These are all in-person classes. This is way before COVID and before the big need. When I lived in the UK, we have something called open studios in every area. So if you're an artist that lives in that area, you can sign up for open studios, which means that you agree for the public to wander in and you can sell your art. You can just show them what you do. You basically open your studio up and they will, I think it's a week long thing. So it's 1 week with the weekend. And they will advertise this. You're on the trail, the art trail, and they give people a map that you can download and so you can stop at each artist's studio. And that's how I found a lot of the teachers that I learned from, because you go see their work and you're like, oh, I love that she does this or that. Like, how did you do this? And some of them are just through artists, but some of them are artists slash teachers. So then I would be like, oh, can I teach a class? And so I took this amazing rust dye class from a lady named Jill Miller. So she has this beautiful studio that's in her garden. She teaches you how to rust fabric and paper, I think too, but mostly fabric. And then we made things with that rusted fabric. And I found her doing the open studios. I think I can't remember what area she was in. But yeah, so you find all these things and there's just so much that they can have a week's long open studio that you won't even be able to see all of the artist studios in that week. I feel like it's so accessible there. Every country has pros and cons too.
Yeah.
Like here, you can buy all the art supplies super easily, which isn't true in every other country.
I'm looking at the Hope and Elvis website, and I'm familiar with Jane Shipp, who was a fodder school two teacher. And there's other people I'm very familiar with who teach here. So I imagine that this isn't that far away. I don't know, unless people are flying in, but yeah, this is super cool.
Yeah, don't forget, Brits are so used to only driving 20 minutes to anywhere they want to go, unless there's traffic, like getting to Heathrow is like everybody's big nightmare because the traffic is so bad. But I lived in Winchester, which is almost on the South Coast. And I used to take my sewing machine up to the middle of the UK to be serviced. And when I would tell people when they took classes from me and they'd ask, oh, where do I have my sewing? And I'd say, oh, I just drive up to Brother, which is in Manchester, I think, or Liverpool, I forget. And they were like, you do what? Like to them, that's such a distance, but it's actually only 4 hours. The UK is not massive.
Right. No, it's...
So when you're like American or South African and you're used to driving like 2 hours to go have your haircut, you'd really, not quite, but you know, you're quite happy to drive this beautiful English countryside to go have your sewing machine serviced at somebody reputable. So yeah, for me, driving up to Hope and Elvis, then Nottingham, it's
super fun. Okay, so you moved from Germany to the UK.
Yes.
More fabric art opens up for you, more mixed media, not just fabric, everything with fabric, right? It's not just traditional sewing. It's, media textile art.
Yes.
Okay, and how long did you live there for?
So 2 years in Winchester, which is almost on the South Coast, and then 2 years up near where Shakespeare was from, Stratford-upon-Avon. We lived like half an hour away from, 20 minutes away from Stratford-upon-Avon.
Okay.
So yeah, 2 years coast, 2 years in the middle-ish.
And were you just enjoying yourself taking classes and learning, or were you still working for the embroidery company?
Both. And I was teaching classes. So when we moved to Winchester, there is this beautiful little store called the Consortium, and a three layers of artists, four levels, because there's a basement too. It's like people selling art, people selling wood, like handmade, it's almost like Etsy in a store. But then they also had antiques that have been refurbished and like beautiful stuff. And on the top level, there was this Annie, what was her? I forget what the name of her sewing studio is. But anyway, I took a class there and then I phoned her and I said, I just moved from Berlin and I'd like to teach. And she was like, oh, well, let's meet. And so we met at the Winchester Library and I showed her what I was teaching in Berlin and what I could do. And I literally started working for her the next week. She since opened her own big sewing studio in Stockbridge, which is another beautiful little town, but originally she was in the Consortium. And so I was teaching for her, and then I was teaching at another sewing school nearby, half an hour's drive away. So I was doing those two, and then I was still doing the digitizing for Artistic Threadworks, and I was taking a ton of classes as well. So yeah, a mix of everything.
Sounds like a dream life.
And then I met my wonderful Scottish friend. I taught a class the one day. I was signed up to teach a free motion embroidery class the next morning. And Annie phoned me at 9 in the evening and she was like, oh, you're supposed to have, I think it was 6 people were supposed to come for the class. And 5 of them were coming together. They were like a group of girlfriends. And one of them had something tragic happen with the family. And so they're all canceled. Do you want me to cancel with the final person, like one person on their own? So, do you know what? It's so late. They probably planned their day for tomorrow. I've planned my day. I'm like, she can just have a private class. And it turned out to be who's now one of my very good friends, Kathleen. And we started chatting and she was telling me all these interesting things. And then she got me another job. I was doing work for a charity that it's PCF, Filipino Community Fund. And it's this amazing woman, Jane, who had gone to the Philippines for work and just seen the amount of poverty and need there. And so she saw families living in the rubbish dumps. And she was horrified that people actually lived like that. So she wanted to know what they needed and what she could do to help. And so she lived with them for, I think, 2 weeks with no running water, no sewer. Like, literally, she just lived with them to really understand. Because she saw all these charities going and doing things that weren't realistically helping. And she thought to herself, if I need to know what they need, I need to live there and see. And so she started this amazing, it started just to get the people off the rubbish dumps into homes. And what she realized was that to sustain the family, they needed the women to work. And if the women could earn money, it saved the whole family. So she started this project where they would make things out of the waste that they were collecting. So they make these ring pull bags, the little tab that's on the can of Coke or whatever it is, that little tab that you're, that thing pulls right off, and they make amazing things with that. But they were starting to get into making other things too. And so I was doing pattern design for all kinds of things. They had a company donate the old billboards that are made out of this amazingly durable and waterproof stuff. And so we made raincoats for all the kids that lived there, because they have quite monsoony weather and they have no kind of protection. So if you get wet and you still have to go to school, you're just going to sit there and be damp all day. So we used those billboards and I made a pattern to make very one size fits all kind of rain poncho kind of things. And toiletry bags or pan bags and all kinds of things. So I was doing work with her with that as well. And then ended up through that same charity, ended up teaching sewing in a women's prison in Gloucester, I think it is. But it's a women's only prison and it's no security. Forget they grade them. I think it's a C, which means it's, I forget which way it works. But anyway, it's a not very serious offenses and low security women's prison. And so I was going there once a week to teach them sewing classes. And the plan was that they would be able to be hired. We already had companies waiting to hire them because there's a gap in the market for people that can sew, that could make curtains for the ready-made and not that one step between buying on Amazon and having them made to fit is the stores in the UK that sell the fabric and they will make standard length. I put that in inverted commas because there's no such thing in the UK with all those old homes. Yeah, but anyway, so they would sell those. And if we could get the girls fully trained, they were yep, no questions asked. They have a job. So that was an amazing opportunity to do that and get involved. Just eye-opening, things that you had never been involved with before. I didn't know the first thing about prison system.
You have incredible life experiences, Di.
Moving around, you just end up doing, so Jane and I end up going to Tanzania because they had seen what she did in the Philippines and they wanted companies to come and work with people in Tanzania because there's also in Africa, there's a lot of areas. And people go with the right intentions, but they don't do what's really needed, ground level needs. And so Jane was roped into going to Tanzania and we ended up working. We were supposed to just work with people with albinism. They call themselves albinos. I know that's not PC in other countries, but in Tanzania, they very merrily call themselves albinos. And there's a big problem there with that, which you can Google. It's terrible. It's really
discrimination against albino people.
Oh, it's even bigger than that because in Africa, there's a lot of people who still believe in Ngomans or Ngomans. It's witch doctors, exactly.
Yeah.
And so there's a belief, and I'm sorry, maybe there should be a trigger warning to this part, but there's a belief that if you take in sort of, I'll put say medicine and inverse commas, that's made from the body parts of a person with albinism, you will become very wealthy. And so these poor people who are already, you can imagine being an albino in the African sun with bright sunshine and very limited resources, so not great access to sunscreen and all of that, you're already like, life is quite tough. And then you have this added danger. And there used to be a lot of stigmatism to it because people didn't really understand the genetics of it. And so then they would accuse women of, if they'd been involved with a white man or if they'd been involved with a witch or something, a devil or whatever. And so men would often leave the woman with the child. And so they've lost their income. They've lost their sort of safety. And so we were supposed to go and just work with them. But when the people, the local people heard that Jane was coming and that she was teaching them sewing, and they already know how to sew. But it's not like here where you can just open your laptop, Google, oh, new handbag pattern, and you can download and print the patterns. And they just don't have access to those kind of resources. But when they heard we were coming, then they asked, oh, could you also teach this group of girls that have finished school but don't have employment? And could you also teach this group that it's an amazing thing. These, I think there are 5 nuns that look after a village of people. Leprosy still happens in Africa. And there's this village where when people, leprosy flares up, they need to go back and have treatment and whatever. And the older people didn't get treatment early enough. Leprosy, often they lose their fingers and toes and things like that. So you've got these aged people who can't look after themselves because lack of extremities. And 5 nuns look after this village. At the minimum people that they look after, I think, is 16. And the maximum, I think it's 50. And they get up during the night and make tea for the old people to keep them warm because the nights get cold. And these sisters are incredible. And they have a little dairy. They make money in every which way you can imagine. But they also sew some items, and they were really keen to have new patterns that they thought would appeal. Because where they are in Tanzania, it's right at the foot of Kilimanjaro. So people all come there. It's a tourism mecca. So they have the opportunity to sell to foreigners who are traveling and keen to buy mementos. So they were keen for us to show them things that we would buy and we were visiting. So we made handbag patterns and like things that they hadn't thought of. And then the girls that had just graduated, we taught them to make those reusable sanitary napkins because they only have Always there. It's a brand that, and it's like the cost of that can be a week's earnings. So a lot of the girls just don't have access to that. So there's a t-shirt making factory down the road. And they were willing to give us their scraps. And so we taught the girls how to make the reusable fabric sanitary napkins. And then when I was showing them how you put it on your knickers, they were like, because I just quickly made a pair of knickers because I hadn't taken a new pair to show them. And they were like, you can make knickers? Like, yeah, you can make knickers easily. You just need elastic and t-shirting from the company down the road. And they call them slippy. They were like, we can make snips. That's another thing that, like, Westerners, we just take things like that for granted. That, of course, everyone has knickers. But they said that a lot of their clothing comes from charity things. You donate your clothing and it goes to Africa, and you, like, it's supposed to be just donated, but they buy it at the marketplace. But nobody donates used knickers. So they don't have access a lot of the time to knickers because it's too expensive to buy brand new ones. So yeah, they were so excited that they could make knickers.
Wow. You have just had a lot of amazing experience. So how do you end up leaving the UK? Because it sounds like you were having this incredible experience there.
I had the most wonderful experience. My husband's work was so demanding and draining, and he was driving like an hour and a half each way to his office. And so he didn't have quite the amazing experience I did. And I think he had just had enough of the massive commutes. And so when they offered him an intercompany transfer to come and work in California, he was like, oh, yes. And I was like, well, I don't mind. I'd always said I wanted to come and live in the States at some point.
Gotcha. Yeah,
that was
wow. That. Wow. You gave up a lot. Okay. Did you go right from the UK to Southern California?
Oh, yes. Originally, we were in Irvine, Southern California. When we were leaving, yeah, we didn't know anything about where to live in the area. We knew where my husband's office was, which at that stage was in Garden Grove, very near California Disney. And but we didn't know, and we were here for a test a week. So in that week, we needed to find somewhere to live. But I still had all my contacts from Berlin days, and a lot of my friends in the International Women's Club were American. So I just phoned or emailed all of them and said, okay, need help. What area do you advise? And they all said, in a limited time, just take Irvine, because it's like everywhere in Irvine is fine to live. You'll enjoy living anywhere there. So we did. We followed the advice and found a house in a week and went back to the UK for a couple of weeks and packed everything up and got everything organized and then moved.
And so your husband had a new job. Were you able to transport all of your equipment and your supplies to Southern California?
Well, so Eugene was working with the same company and they organize everything and pay for everything for you. Or you can take the payouts and choose things for yourself. So we did option two. And because the electrics are different between the Hertz and the Volt are different, so anything with the computer in it isn't going to work. So you can't bring any of your electrics with you. But, and then like furniture, we left most everything behind. We brought a few sentimental pieces. The biggest thing I brought was a fabric supply. It took up the most boxes. And then we brought some clothing and wool art that we had in the UK. And that's Eugene's all his sports equipment. He does Ironman competitions, so he has all his equipment for that, and of course I have all my art supplies. Oh, there were a few things that they were like, the packers, you have to use an international company, and there are lots of things you're not allowed to take, and a lot of art supplies have some of the chemicals in them that you're theoretically not supposed to take. I probably shouldn't be saying this, but I just double wrapped everything so they couldn't read what was in it. And every time they asked me, what is this? I was like, oh, art supplies, watercolor, because watercolor is really easy and there's nothing in it. And they were like, okay, they packed it merrily and I have all my art supplies. There were a few things that you just know you can't take, the whatever, or dye, whatever it was like that you, but otherwise it all came. But yeah, I sold all my sewing machines and that in the UK and then replaced them when we got here.
So how did you find your community in Southern California?
Yeah, that is something I always say, you find the best people in creative outlets.
Yeah.
I literally have found my whole friendship base through art and crafting. I started taking, so in Irvine, there's this amazing, the Irvine Fine Art Studio. And I think we've been here 2 weeks and I signed up for a class and a watercolor class. And met some really lovely people. And the girl who taught the class, Mary Lee, I'm still friends with her to this day. I started our sketchy group on a Friday. We were all taking art classes with this amazing art teacher, Kat Goldberg. And we were saying we meet once a week for 3 hours and we learn stuff. But it would be really lovely, it was a sketching class. It would be really lovely to sit and sketch together. So we all talked about it. Nobody kind of did anything. And eventually I thought, okay, well, I want it. So I guess I'm going to have to organize it. So I found that we've got this amazing independent bookstore in the area. And I had taken a few classes. They also, they do brush lettering classes and all things like that. And I'd taken a few classes there and got to know the owners, Sam and Mike. The bookstore is called Arvida. Actually, I think they say it differently. But anyway. And they have this beautiful garden, like a little outdoor section with umbrellas and a sail over. So it's shaded and they've got lovely wooden tables outside. And they very kindly agreed to let our art group use that every Friday for a couple of hours. So we meet every Friday from 10 till 12-ish. And we all just take whatever we're working on and we work on it collectively. And then everybody invites like their auntie friends. So one of the guys in the group, he works at Disney. So he's an illustrator at Disney. So he brought some of his Disney friends. So like, we've got an amazing one guy that comes is an architect, retired architect. So there's people with different skills and you learn from each other. And it's great fun. And my original art teacher that I started taking classes with comes to that group as well. So yeah, it's all basically true art.
Do you think you're done moving or do you think there's another move in your future?
Oh, Wendy, that's always a good question. With my husband, you just never know. We're a little bit more settled now. We just bought our home here in Mission Viejo. And before that, the last home we owned, we still had our home in South Africa. And a few years ago, and we sold it. But like before this, we've always rented because it's always been very sort of, well, we'll see how it goes. And we were sort of looking at settling a bit longer. And I said, oh, maybe we should look at buying. And he agreed. I thought, okay, he really enjoys being here. We can sort of put down some roots for a bit.
So that's nice. You've put down roots. All right. So your experience, all of this experience, all of the places you've lived and the techniques you've learned and the people you've learned from, what would you say you're working on now? And how does it reflect all of this experience? What are you really passionate about right now?
Oh, goodness. That's a moving target every day. I will get into something and then do that. Like at the moment, as we are talking, I am busy painting on fabric. It's something I've loved doing for years. So I'm busy making a toiletry bag with a blue jay on it. So I'm busy painting. As we are chatting, I'm painting this little blue jay on linen to make into a toiletry bag. And that's something I've been doing. I do things on and off. A few weeks ago, I had got back into lingerie making and I was fiddling with my bra patterns. A few weeks before that, I was loving brush lettering and I was like doing brush lettering. A few weeks before that, I was doing like, it's just one of those.
I love that. You're fully a mixed media artist. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you is I've experienced that for some people, there is a bit of a resistance when it comes to sewing. In general, someone might be a fully mixed media artist. They love paper and all that stuff and glue and scissors. But then it's like making that leap of using a sewing machine. I mean, I've even experienced in my own life. So I grew up using a sewing machine, but then time went by where I wasn't using a sewing machine. And then I got very fearful about it. And now that I'm back into it, it's like the most natural thing in the world.
Yes, you kind of can't believe you stepped back.
You can't believe, first of all, you can't believe that you are afraid.
Yes.
And I mean, I've definitely used a machine on and off many periods throughout my life. And now I have a machine set up in my studio and I have a second machine set up in a secondary basement sewing space. So we've got two machines that are like fully functional, available for anyone to use at any time. My daughters use them. It's almost, wow, how could you just not have a sewing machine in your home? And what I want people to hear, and I want them to hear it from you, is, and I'm going to say it, but I feel like you have so much experience teaching people, like a sewing machine is nothing to be afraid of. A sewing machine is extremely easy to use once you begin using it. So can you talk about what it's like
for
people?
This is something I think it's the way we were taught at school growing up. Or like, I remember school sewing was such a drag. We had to pin, then we had to do loose tacking, then we had to do like a tack lid by hand, then we had to do a tack with the sewing machine. And then only when all of that was right, were we allowed to sort of finally sew the jolly seam. And it made it so, there's a beautiful German word, langweilig, laborious. Laborious is a good one. It's the translation. It's so laborious that it like takes all the joy out of it. So something interesting, when I was teaching classes in Berlin, sewing and textile art, I would have people who had sewing machines they'd inherited or whatever. And, oh, okay, like I've had this machine. It would actually be great to use it and they'd come along adults. And there'd always be this fear hurdle that we had to overcome. Like they'd just get comfortable with making a scatter cushion, like with a flap closure. And then I'd say the dreaded word zip, and they'd be like, oh, a zip. Oh, gracious. No, we have to put in a zipper. Oh, they're terrified. And then one of my friends, her son is super creative. He's actually, I mean, at that stage, he wasn't even like 4 yet, but he's now, I think he's, I don't know how many years ago that is, but he's a teenager anyway. And she said to me, oh, he's really keen to learn to sew. Would you teach him? And I said, yeah, okay. If you're going to get him a sewing machine, then sure, I'll teach him. Because there's no point you learning on my machine and then you can't practice. I always say, if you want to learn to sew, you just have to get a sewing machine. And you can get a, not the starter machine that you buy at the supermarket. Those are generally rubbish and they'll put you off sewing for life. But a good Brother machine or a good Husqvarna, whatever it is, you can get that kind of machine and you're set for life, basically. So anyway, yeah. He starts, they get him the machine. I'm like, don't buy him a kiddie's machine. Those things are awful. Get him a regular sewing machine and I'll just adapt the foot pedal so that it can't sew too fast and he'll be fine. So we start going and like he takes his first class and he makes this really simple pair of trousers. They're just like those sort of taekwondo type trousers. So they're super simple. He makes that, he goes home with them. Like in 2 hours, he's made something and can wear it and he's super thrilled. The next week he comes and I said to him, okay, we're going to make a zip bag. And he's like, okay, great. Show me how. No fear whatsoever. And he jumped right in. He did it perfectly. There was no problem. And I really realized then, like teaching a four-year-old compared to teaching an adult, that we have these built-in, oh, it's so difficult to sew zips. Why? It's a straight line. It's one of the easiest things you could sew. You just have to make sure that, you know, the teeth are out of the way. And that's easy to do. If you have the right equipment for the job, it's a super simple thing to do. And I realized the difference teaching a child with no preconceived ideas who was just like, oh, okay, the next thing we're learning is a zip. Great. Jumped right in with 2 feet and off he went. And compared to teaching an adult who had this, I think there's this like innate fear of, I don't know why, because, and especially if you start getting into free motion. So free motion embroidery is drawing with a sewing machine. It's as simple as that. And it is such fun. You can convert any sewing machine to be able to do free motion. There's nothing special. It's just a regular sewing machine. It's basically in the good old days when sewing machines were invented, that one of the purposes that they were invented for was to do darning. And basically, free motion is the same as darning. Everyone always asks me, is it bad for your machine? Can it break something? You can break the needle like any sewing. You can break a needle, but that's it. And so basically, it's like drawing, but moving your paper instead of moving your pen. That's basically when you do free motion. And once, I think if you have any kind of fear of a sewing machine, get into free motion embroidery. You'll realize how intuitive and manageable it is. And yeah, it's just such fun. Why wouldn't you want to do it? And it's because so much easier.
The only reason is fear. It's like people think that that there's something scary about it.
Scary.
They're going to hurt themselves or break
them. Yes. Or break something. Yeah.
Right. And it's so easy.
It's going to be something that a four-year-old can learn to sew a zip in a half an hour, then so can you. It's really nothing holding you back except your own brain that's for some reason telling you this is something tough and it's not.
So in fodder school and fodder challenge, there are going to be a lot of people who are very comfortable with a sewing machine. And then, of course, there's going to be a lot of people who are not comfortable with a sewing machine. And with me and my sort of thoughts about this is fodder school is a really great way to push yourself into a zone that isn't the places you've already been. So things like wax collage, eventually we're going to be doing encaustics, things that seem very untouchable or very scary or foreign that actually, once you have a competent teacher, just hold your hand and show you the way.
They push you out of your comfort zone. But the great thing with fodder school, because I've been taking it from the beginning, it's not that you're pushed. You're gently guided step by step with fail-safe. So you can learn anything online, but it's generally going to be hit or miss, right? Whereas fodder school, you're learning from people who've learned everything there is to know about that thing that they're teaching you. And they know all the little things that make it easier, that make it guarantee better results. Yeah. For me, that's been like the joyous part of school. Like, I know I'm always going to have something amazing as an end result. Whereas you take some classes and you're like, well, I don't know. One, you don't always know. I've taken a class where I thought it was something, and then they taught me something. It wasn't what I had in my head, wasn't what they were teaching. And so I was unhappy with my results. Whereas boarding school, you're like, every month you're doing something different. So if you didn't love that month, which I so far haven't experienced, then wait for next month and you can try something else. And even if, so this is what I really love about boarding school, like going through all classes. Even if I'll make a photo with the person, and or I'll make the photo their way and maybe use it in a different way or a tweak it some way, or I will use stuff I've made in previous photo classes to still complete the project. Maybe you don't have the time in a month to do both sections. It's fine. You can just mix and match.
Absolutely. You're always using things from other months if you want to. In another month, you develop this really big stash and things
yep.
get put in.
And some of the things I'm just like, the first time you see it, it's just like something you'll use for, like Jane Chip's photo challenge, making those buttons.
Yeah.
That is something I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life. I think it's the most ingenious thing I've ever learned. And I don't know why I never thought to do it before, but
I don't think it's something that many people would just think up. I think that was a very special lesson.
Incredible.
Yeah. And those Jane's lessons pushed me the most out of my comfort zone. Her lessons in fodder school too, where we were using a scanner and a printer and we were printing on tissue. That may seem very simple to some people, but for me, it was really pushing me out of my comfort zone. I felt so accomplished that I was able to do it. And none of it was hard. Like, I had built up in my mind that these things were complicated and hard, but if you just follow the instructions of the teacher and you get the supplies
that you need. About being like handheld through the process. Like, you don't have to try all the tiny ways like tissue paper goes through your printer and jam your printer like I did before I took Jane's class. I have had to pull tweezers, painstakingly pull each little piece of tissue paper out of the printer because for some reason I thought it could just go through. And then, like, you take Jane's class and she tells your hand, steps you through it, and you can, like, it's the tips and tricks that you don't know what you don't know.
So, probably with Fodder School 3, like, your lessons are some of the ones I'm looking most forward to because I know that you're going to be teaching me things that on my own I would never be doing. I would just not be doing those things. I wouldn't know about the products that you specify. I wouldn't even know what I'm capable of. But you are going to show me these things that you've been doing for years. And then I'll be like, oh my gosh, I had no idea I was even capable of doing that thing with fabric.
I guarantee you somebody will take what I show them and do it and tweak it and grow it even further. It's just, for me, it was an obvious thing. I love fabric, I love art. Like, it makes sense to be able to merge the two things. And then, I don't want to give too much away, but using that, like how all the many ways you could use it. Yeah,
Emperor,
to me, it's like a natural fit. I love doing this. And I love, my little niece came to still, she's not little anymore, but my husband's brother has 3 kids. And as each one turned 16, they came to stay with us wherever we were living for a month because they grew up in South Africa. And so they like to give them an opportunity to live for a month somewhere else in the world. So the older two came to Berlin. And then the youngest one, Annie, she came to stay with us in the UK. And Annie and I totally share a number of passions. And so fabric, sewing, and art. And so I taught her how to do the painting on fabric. And she's since then, I mean, she came when she was 16 and that would have been 8 years ago, I think. And so since then, she's grown up, she's finished her study, she's got married, and she started a little business where she makes all the sewn things with hand painting on it, and she teaches classes. So she still lives in Port Elizabeth in South Africa, where my husband is from. And so she set up this whole business doing that. And I love seeing it on Instagram. I remember sitting with her in my art room in our house in Bert Green and teaching her how to do it. And I could see her excitement like I had been excited when I first started figuring it out, how to do it and what to do. And yeah, I think it's one of those things that you might just do this project and think, oh, well, that was fun, but I won't use it again. Or you might be like me and be like, oh my goodness, I can see where this can take me. And you'll think of something that I didn't think of, that the people who taught me didn't think of it. It's absolutely just one of those things that you can totally build and run with.
All right. It's been a bit and we've loved hearing your story. Yes. And we can't wait to get to know you in depth during your month, which we don't know which month is your month yet, but you will be one of the months in Fodder School 3. So is there anything else that you want to say before we end this podcast recording?
Wendy, I have spoken so much. I think I've told a whole life story.
That's what this is for.
I'm really excited for teaching the class and to see how people embrace it and what they do with it. I can't wait for that.
It's going to be really fun. And we're happy to hear your story. I'm beginning to realize that this is such an important part of the Fodder School process, is getting to know people on a much deeper level, recording an episode, having people have the opportunity if they want to hear someone's full story, because then when they start taking your classes, it's just a different experience. I think it has the potential to be a very different experience, because now people feel like they know you. So it's not just coming in cold. It's, oh, it's Di. Here's Di teaching me, not a stranger teaching. So I think this is going to be a really interesting, engaging experience.
Oh, I was very excited to have this opportunity. So Wendy and Tiffany, thank you.
All right. We're so welcome. Thanks for coming on today, Di.
It was lovely to chat to you, Wendy. Have
lovely
a good
to
day.
Talk to you. You too. Good luck with the floor.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Show Up or Shut Up with Wendy Solganic. If you've made some art or craft while you listened, take a photo of it. Post it to Instagram and tag me at willa.wanders so I can see what you were up to. And if you feel like what we talked about here spoke to you today, please hit the subscribe button so that you will be the first to know about new episodes of this podcast. Have a wonderful day. Go create something, anything, and I hope you find your flow.